I'm Jen Psaki. Welcome to Diplopod. In the wake of the 2016 election, there's been a lot of soul searching here in Washington among foreign policymakers about how policies impact the middle class across the United States. Salman Ahmed, who has served at the highest levels of government, both in the White House and the United Nations, has been leading an effort at Carnegie to explore exactly that question. I recently sat down with him to discuss the work he's been doing in Ohio, what he learned, how his perceptions have changed, and what it means for future foreign policymakers. Well, thank you so much for joining me in the podcast, the Diplopod Studio. So you've spent, I mean, you and I worked together at the White House, and you've spent really decades working at a senior level in government, for the UN, on foreign policy issues. So let's start with why you decided to study the impact of foreign policy on the middle class.
So thanks for having me. It's true that I spent a long time working on foreign policy, and most of the time I looked at it through the lens of what's happening geopolitically and from a security perspective overseas. And that made a lot of sense, clearly for people during the Cold War. I started in the post-Cold War period, where I think a lot of our thinking remained at the time in that frame. And post 9/11, people started thinking in terms of what does the world look like in terms of dealing with the terrorist threat. But after the global financial crisis and the Great Recession, and absent one singular threat around the world that galvanized the country, it really started raising questions for people as to what's the economic rationale for people at home of what we're doing abroad. And what I found when working in government is that a lot of the foreign policy people, and I would include myself, were not fully equipped to actually answer the question, because that requires really knowing what are the economic challenges Americans are facing. And the fact is that the economic realities for Americans were increasingly diverging.
And do you think that's because, I mean, when you're working in many of the senior level jobs you have, you're basically in the Situation Room, you're writing memos. I mean, you don't really get out to the country a lot, right? Is that part of it, or it's more of a economic policy understanding that's the disconnect?
I think there are a lot of disconnects. So in the Situation Room, you've got the national security team. I'm sure the Department of Commerce is there, the Treasury is there to make sure that the economic dimensions of our policy are represented. But for those of us who are national security foreign policy specialists, you tend to defer to the economists, the international economists, and keep your focus on the geopolitics. Meanwhile, there's a whole other universe that's working on domestic policy. And these two universes are really separate. The policy spheres in government are quite separate.
Yeah, and some of it I think we've seen even with, this is a weird example to use, but Steve Bannon and him being in the sitting in Situation Room meetings, there was some controversy even in the Obama administration about whether David Axelrod and Robert Gibbs and others should sit in there. And it was seen as those people are raising domestic issues, but they were seen as political, right? So what you're saying kind of is there are domestic issues. It's not necessarily political. It's their substantive issues that are impacting communities.
Absolutely. And members of Congress are seized by the economic challenges their constituents face. The president, having to sit over domestic and foreign policy, has to look at how these things intersect. But there aren't that many people in government. Sometimes the chiefs of staff, White House chiefs of staff, but there aren't that many who see all sides. And the problem with that then is that you end up with disconnects. So you have one group of people who are saying that we need XYZ policies that will position us geopolitically in the world in the following way. And you have another group of people that are having to deal with the economic challenges working families face, and they may not always intersect in the right way.
Yeah. Do you think there's a process and a functional piece of this that could mean how people think about in future administrations that they interact, right? I know you don't have the answer to this, but that seems to be part of it.
Well, we went into this exercise and formed a task force and are doing this research to try to come up with answers.
Right.
You know, but early on, I think that we already realized that, sure, there must be a process piece of this. How are you going to get these two communities to intersect with each other, interact more? But it's not only process, because individuals just need to bring that lens or way of thinking to the work they do as well. So if you're going to be someone who proposes a deeper trade agenda because it serves your strategic interest or geopolitical interest, you probably need to be more informed as well about how that might play economically at home. And clearly we saw some disconnects on that front with the debate over TPP last election.
That's true. So you've answered this a bit, but a lot of organizations study the middle class, study the economy and the impact of issues like trade. What makes the work you're doing different and the work of this task force different?
I think it's absolutely the case that a lot of the challenges that America's middle class faces economically will need to be solved through fiscal policy, monetary policy, domestic policy. It goes to questions of healthcare, childcare, occupational licensing, transportation, the role of collective bargaining, so many things that are really in the purview of the domestic sphere. But what's happened now is that you have a circumstance in which President Trump, or then candidate Trump during the last election, was talking about the need for actually even a different U.S. foreign policy because he claimed that the one pursued by his predecessors, Democratic and Republican alike, were benefiting foreign economic competitors and allies at the expense of the American worker. And you also have a lot of progressive Democrats who've, at least in the area of trade, expressed concern that the trade and international economic agenda pursued in the past has maybe served American corporate interests well, but not necessarily those of American working families. Mm-hmm. And so you've got some policy changes in the international realm that are on the table now or actually being pursued. And meanwhile, you've got people in the foreign policy establishment also expressing deep fear that those very changes that are claimed to help the middle class could end up undermining the economy and in turn hurting those people. So it's a big debate. It therefore affects the future of U.S. foreign policy and the trajectory of international relations. And we're nowhere near right now to a point of coming to answers that may endure the transition from one administration to another.
Yeah. And I mean, not just Trump, right? The politics have totally changed on trade after the last election, or one can assume that given Bernie Sanders' view on trade and Hillary Clinton coming out against TPP in the lead up to the election. So politically, there's opposition. And you're kind of referencing the concern that causes by some who have worked in foreign policy. What's your view, as you've kind of explored this and sat in on all these interviews, how has your view on the impact of trade changed or evolved?
Yeah. So I should also, I realize it didn't fully answer the last question, answer of why are we doing this, is there are people working on the domestic side and there are people working on trade. And those two items on their own, they need a hard look. And other organizations and groups are well-placed to do that. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do, though, is also to say, you know, take a wider look and a step back and say, well, how much does trade matter relative to other aspects of foreign policy? And how much does foreign policy matter relative to the domestic policy? So there's a need to take a look at things overall. And my views on trade have evolved in different contradictory ways so far, just based on the work we've done on Ohio alone. On the one hand, I probably didn't appreciate the extent of trade-related dislocation that played out across Ohio. Or rather, I knew it in numbers, but when you actually get out to those towns and cities and talk to people who are trying to pick up the pieces, you become aware that it's not just about individual workers being displaced and requiring trade adjustment assistance to help them make a transition. It's about the effect on entire cities and towns. And what does that mean for their economic future? And that becomes more real. And to be perfectly clear, there are plenty of people who have been talking about this for decades and who are aware of it. It's just that when you're focused on the international community, you can sometimes lose sight of the existential threats that our local communities at home face.
I mean, the difference is if you're working on the, like, what's in our best interest globally and not taking into account what's happening domestically, that's often what happens, I think, is what you're kind of saying.
Absolutely. On the other hand, in talking to people on the ground, you realize that how much trade is a proxy also for a wider set of issues. So we looked at how the manufacturing industry, for example, in Ohio has evolved over the last 50 years, and we've heard from people giving their explanations. And they talked about a lot of different factors, including the loss of just simply local ownership of businesses and competition with other U.S. states and the impact of technology and the transformation of the unions, both in terms of what some believed was inflexibility by the unions in an earlier time that drove business away, but others really worrying about the loss of collective bargaining power to press for higher wages. You go down the list and you realize that at heart, often what people were talking about was a breakdown in a social contract between government and business and labor and communities. And it's wrapped up in the trade debate to some degree because there isn't a place to have this even wider debate.
Yeah.
So it helps put the trade issue in perspective. I'd say a third way in which my views changed is that it's easy to assume that the views on trade in states like Ohio somehow differ from those on the coast. And in Ohio, we heard a real diversity of views. And if you're in Columbus, Ohio, there are many people who said, well, the more trade, the more openness, the more immigration, the better, because they see being globally connected as pretty central to the fact that they've become like maybe the eighth fastest growing city in the country. But you don't have to go far outside of Columbus to smaller places like a Marion or Coshocton, where their experiences and how they've been affected by globalization are quite different. And so I think that we'd be wise to really recognize the diversity of views that exist within states and not make assumptions about there being bloc views.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point. And one of the issues you've talked about and you talk about in this report is China. And how there's a kind of a contradicting, unintentionally view, right, of a opposition to China and a desire for China to invest, even if it's not articulated that way. And some of that was what you found, I believe. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. You will find, at least we found with the 7 dozen or so interviews we conducted, and you know, I would caution, we realized that that's still a relatively small sample size. But nonetheless, what was uniform across it was an awareness or even a resentment that not enough had been done in the past by previous administrations, Republican and Democratic alike, to contend with what people saw as objectionable, unfair Chinese trading practices. And so there is, on some level, a support to push back harder. There is certainly people fearing the idea of China displacing the U.S. and dictating the terms of global trade. Yet, on the other hand, we heard some of those same people, of course, expressing fears about the retaliatory effects of tariffs that we place on Chinese goods that could redound negatively for some of Ohio's industries, like soybeans. But more than that, people talked about the effect on foreign direct investment because the same people who want to push back harder against China on trade also say that we want to invite more foreign direct investment from China. And there's an example often used is when the GM assembly plant in Moraine, Ohio, shut down in 2008. The economic developers in Ohio managed to offset the blow in part by securing a $600 million investment from the Chinese Fuyao glass industry. And, yeah, it's just the first salvo, and the G7 countries provide a lot more of the FDI, not China. But it's a question people have on their minds is, you know, well, could it change in the case of China, too? And they remember that Japan was the source of really deep anxiety and resentment in the 1970s. But now, today, Japan is the leading provider of FDI. It accounts for 70,000 jobs. Honda is the
top. Not a big political issue being anti-Japan at all.
Right. So, and they're now, Honda is the top manufacturing employer there. So people say, well, if that's how things can change in 30 years, or, you know, perhaps the same thing could happen with China. But there are also real differences between our relationship with Japan as an ally and China. So the jury's out on that. It's just simply to illustrate that there are trade-offs with respect to China itself.
Right, and it's not kind of 100% one way or the other, which is, I think, such an interesting takeaway that a lot of people who are sitting in Washington and don't make it to Ohio and interview lots of people don't always see. So as part of this effort, you spent a lot of time on the ground in Ohio, and you really talked to people about what the impact was of job losses or factory closings. Can you talk a little bit about what you heard from people on the ground?
So when, of course, for people who had manufacturing jobs in the smaller cities and towns, when those jobs went away, they didn't have an alternative employment that paid the same amount. And so there was a different, it's a different circumstance if you're in a large city with a diversified economy where other options may exist. Of course, your options are more limited if you don't have a college degree or an advanced degree in those big cities. And so that is one reality, which I think has been talked about quite frequently by a lot of people.
Yeah,
I think the things that aren't discussed as frequently are the impact on communities. So, for example, in Coshocton, when there was a paper mill there, that corrugated box plant, and it requires a lot of water. And when that plant left town, the town had all this excess water capacity. It was something they could market to try to attract other manufacturing industries. But in the gap, it meant that the residents had to pay about 38% more for their water bills.
Yeah.
And what a lot of people talk about on the local level is they say, we understand automation, we understand market forces, we believe in capitalism, and we understand that it's a global economy. But what does it mean for us when a company picks up with very little notice, and whether they move to another state or they move overseas, and it leaves us with these hulking assembly plants and buildings and infrastructure that we can't pay for? And they hang like economic millstones around the community's, you know, collective neck. And I think that that doesn't get enough attention, because how can we expect people who are worried about the future of their local communities to take an interest in the health of the international community, which is what the foreign policy people want them to do?
Yeah, and a lot of people don't kind of see that. It often is thought of as, we just need to give this trade adjustment assistance to this one worker, but your point is it's larger than that.
Right. And so the trade adjustment scheme, which meant to help individual displaced workers or businesses displaced by trade, is just a piece of the story. And it points to the need for a discussion on community adjustment that arises out of the needs that communities have due to the loss of jobs from trade or non-trade related issues.
So one of the issues you're also exploring is defense spending, which is obviously a big foreign policy issue, but it has a huge impact on communities because of employers. So how has that come up so far in your research, and how do you anticipate it being a part of the debate?
So, I mean, it's a lot of the foreign policy debate, and you heard it in during the Obama campaign as well, is that, you know, we need to do less nation building abroad in order to do more nation building at home. So it goes to cutting overseas spending. We heard a lot of people express deep concern or resentment about what some called unfunded or unwise or costly wars that last for decades, cost trillions of dollars, add to the debt. But interestingly, the same people would also caution strenuously about cutting defense spending in general, because when a lot of the employers left town or jobs were lost due to trade in a place like Dayton, what kept it afloat was the presence of the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which is the single, which is Ohio's largest single-site employer. And if you go to Lima with the tank production facility, or even Cleveland, across the state, there are families and communities that are touched and benefit from defense spending in a way that most people may not realize. So that might explain why whenever there's a discussion about cutting our spending overseas to help investment at home, people immediately leap to foreign aid. The problem is that the sum total of the U.S. diplomatic and development activities amounts to less than 1% of the federal budget, whereas defense spending is up around 17%. So that's really where the real money is, but it doesn't lend itself to a simple solution, because cutting the defense spending might actually hurt the families, unless you can guarantee that that money is replaced with investments for infrastructure, education, or other things that people want.
Opening alternate employers. It's kind of where they work and where they live and what dominates their community.
That's right. And so it's just part of the same theme that in any one of these given areas, there's a tendency to propose simple solutions. And in fact, you know, you realize that each one has inherent trade-offs and dilemmas that we need to work through. And so as much as there's a attention on trade for example, right now, and that's valid and it needs to be looked at. We also need to get beyond it to look at trade-offs too.
Yeah. Yeah. The foreign aid piece, which you mentioned, is such an interesting one because of the perception of the of how much money we spend on foreign aid, which, as you said, is way off. And there's sort of this terrible irony there that perhaps if we spent more there, we'd be spending less on weapons. You can argue that whether that's true or not, but it's an interesting perception out there in the country.
Absolutely. And but again, it goes to what can people see?
Yeah.
You can see the jobs that are created from trade or jobs lost from trade or defense spending. Foreign aid, harder, although people in the ag industry do see it.
Sure.
In the Farm Bureau, they know that the aid that helps people move out of poverty, for example, increases protein consumption.
Mm-hmm.
That in turn increases the demand for the livestock that's produced in Ohio.
Yeah.
So they can see a connection, but there aren't a lot of people who have that global look and are able to do that.
So you're going to Colorado next, or that's the next case study. Why Colorado?
Well, we wanted to concentrate on the heartland in general because, frankly, there is this perception or criticism that the views in the coastal cities dominate too much of the foreign policy community's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That's what led us to Ohio to begin with. But we also wanted to find different states within the heartland that are quite different from each other.
Mm-hmm.
So Colorado offers a counterpoint. It doesn't have the same relationship with trade and manufacturing that Ohio has, although, of course, those things matter too. But it has some commonalities too. One aspect of the U.S. international engagement that matters a lot is defense spending. And we found that that was much more important in Ohio than we had maybe realized and assumed was more of a reality for the southern states. Well, it's a big issue in Colorado too, but we'd like to understand, is it the same or quite different? So being able to compare and contrast between these states will be illuminating. We're reluctant to make recommendations on one alone. So we'll see after Colorado if we find the questions that emerge from Ohio are similar or, in fact, very different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And part of this, so you're going to be doing a couple of case studies around the country. But at some point, you'll conclude with some recommendations at the end of the process. But presidential campaigns are heating up now already. And there are a lot of people bringing on advisors. And part of this is to kind of better inform the next crew of staffers, right? So what advice would you give for, people who are advising candidates, who are thinking about how to take into account the impact of foreign policy on the middle class?
The first off is people should just recognize that there are aspects of foreign policy that have tangible, measurable economic impacts for people on the ground. Trade's one, foreign direct investments another, defense spending, just given its vast sums, is another. And within each state, you need to understand how people are affected by those things because they will weigh a lot of what you say based on how's it going to affect their bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are all these other aspects of foreign policy that people can't see and you may believe are highly relevant to their economic well-being too. And that can include tax policy in international economics, include how we're pressing other governments to deal with their own economic and monetary policies, currency, dealing with economic crises, or even armed conflicts or other geopolitical developments, disruptions in the supply of oil, things that could affect our economy and in turn people locally. You're going to have to figure out how you make concrete and measurable the things that people can't see. Because you can't base your foreign policy proposals on what people see alone. And that's a huge challenge. And probably one of the big disconnects between the foreign policy establishment in D.C. and on the ground is that they see that the establishment sees the macro issues, but are accused of not being aware of the micro realities. Meanwhile, those who are intimately aware of the micro realities don't have enough of a basis to judge on what the macro level interests of the nation are and how they're best served. So a lot of this is about how, who are the people who are able to bridge that gap?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll be interested to hear more after your trips to Colorado. Thank you so much for joining us in the Diplopod studio. And perhaps we'll talk again once you know more about another state.
Look forward to it.
Diplopod is a production of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Subscribe to Diplopod on popular podcast platforms such as iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Learn more at carnegieendowment.org/diplopod. Tim Martin is our audio engineer. Lauren Duick is our executive producer. I'm Jen Psaki. Thanks for listening.